Good afternoon, and welcome to the Green Thumb Show. I'm Lee Murray, your reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thanks for joining us. From the Arizona Republic, Alfalfa Meal Works Wonders in the Garden by Bob DeLuzon. Alfalfa is one of the most valuable crops farmers grow. It belongs to the legume family of plants. Unlike other plants that must take up nitrogen only by their roots, legumes, with the help of microorganisms that live in their roots, can fix nitrogen directly from the air, placing it into the soil. Even better, alfalfa's roots grow far down into the soil, typically 20 feet, though they can reach depths of 45 feet. Because of this, the roots can recover minerals from deep in the earth and transport them to the growing top of the alfalfa plant. In addition to the primary nutrients of nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium, alfalfa contains a plethora of secondary nutrients and micronutrients in a form highly available to plants, including calcium, magnesium, sulfur, iron, cobalt, manganese, zinc, and selenium. Farmers harvest alfalfa for hay that is fed to cattle, horses, and other livestock. Manure from the farm animals is collected and applied to fields as fertilizer for other crops, such as corn. That crop then has access to all the nutrients that alfalfa absorbed from the subsoil that otherwise would have been lost. Part of the alfalfa crop is used for making dehydrated livestock feed. Bright green, freshly harvested alfalfa is brought to a dehydrating facility where it is immediately processed into meal or pellets, locking in nutrients as a shelf-stable product. As gardeners, we don't have to grow alfalfa ourselves in order to take advantage of all that alfalfa has to offer as a fertilizer. We can simply purchase alfalfa meal or pellets. It's widely available at garden centers or, more economically, at feed and farm stores, usually in 40 or 50-pound bags. Look for non-GMO or organic. With a fertilizer analysis of around 412, alfalfa is a great general-use fertilizer. It contains vitamins A and E, plus amino acids that feed soil microorganisms, and it has naturally occurring plant growth stimulants. Dehydrated alfalfa is particularly good for blooming plants, including roses, dahlias, peonies, and clematis. For roses, use 1 to 2 cups per plant every 6 weeks. In soils that have low fertility, apply at the rate of 50 pounds per 1,000 square feet, medium fertility, 35 pounds, adequate fertility, 25 pounds. Nutrients will be released over 1 to 4 months, which is relatively fast compared to some organic fertilizers, but very slow compared to chemical fertilizers. This makes it safer to use without burning plants by applying too much. A plant tea can be made by steeping 1 cup of dehydrated alfalfa in a 5-gallon bucket of water for a day or longer. Pour into soil around plants as a pick-me-up. To use as a foliar spray, strain out the solids and add a couple drops of a biodegradable dishwashing liquid to help it stick to the leaves, which may help alleviate foliar diseases. Alfalfa is the secret substance to make your gardens healthy, green, and lush with blooms. Here's another article from the Arizona Republic, Dip into Gardening with Self-Watering Containers by Camille Stein. I enjoy small-scale gardening. I don't have very much space, so before I commit myself, I'll try out a new plant. I use plastic or terracotta pots, so there's no way of knowing when it's time to water. I admit that I get wrapped up in other things and forget what day it is, and there are times that I've looked at my plants but don't really see what's going on. When I finally pay attention, they're droopy or wilted or just not right, and I move into crisis mode. I water them every day, and while that may solve the problem for some, it will exacerbate the problem for others. The same thing had happened when asking a neighbor to look after them if I go away for a few days. When I return, some of the plants will look just fine, others not so, through no fault of hers. It seems easy enough to water each plant the same amount at the same frequency, but that may be doing more harm than good, especially if you grow more than one type of plant. Each type has different watering needs. Flowers like impatiens, begonias, and African violets, and vegetables like celery, lettuce, and radishes require frequent watering, while flowers like coneflower, salvia, and verbena, and vegetables like southern peas, okra, and tomatillos are more drought-tolerant. Gardening stops being enjoyable for me when it becomes a burden rather than working with plants to achieve beautiful flowers or a crop of tasty vegetables. So, how can one provide the right amount of water at the right frequency in a small garden that contains more than one type of plant? Of course, the easiest way would be to grow plants with the same watering requirements, but even they must be watered at the same frequency and the right amount, regardless of whether someone is around to see to their needs. A simple alternative is to use a self-watering container. It has a reservoir that must be kept filled, but otherwise the container and growing medium work together to continuously provide water over a long period of time. They can be used in small pots for houseplants or scaled up to 5-gallon buckets for larger growing spaces. In addition, they are a great way to start transplants from seed, root cuttings, or temporarily hold plants until a permanent location is chosen. Some advantages of using a self-watering container include water savings. The average SWC represents a water savings of 60% over in-ground gardening. No sprinklers are needed. Our summer heat may mean that a garden requires daily watering, sometimes even more, making it hard on busy people. A SWC virtually eliminates moisture swings that affect a plant's health and quality. A 3-gallon reservoir will keep a containerized tomato plant watered for 10 days in the summer before it needs refilling. Adding a small piece of a mosquito dunk to the reservoir can prevent mosquito breeding. These inexpensive products, available at most garden centers, use BTI, a naturally occurring soil bacterium that kills mosquito larvae without harming plants, pets, or beneficial insects. Plant health. The SWC is an easy and economical way to provide the right environment for plants with special requirements such as pH and nutrient needs. Because you control the growing medium, soil-borne pests and diseases are also less common than in traditional in-ground gardens. Economy. SWCs can be built from recycled components, including containers that might otherwise end up in a landfill. Because plants draw water from the reservoir below rather than being watered from the top, nutrient leaching is significantly reduced compared to traditional containers or in-ground gardens. Accessibility. A SWC can be built above knee height and tended from a sitting position, including a wheelchair. No need to give up gardening after knee or back surgery. An SWC is friendly to seniors and to school children for their first gardening experience. How it works. Self-watering containers use a wick that reaches from the water reservoir to the plant's root zone, creating a self-regulating hydration system. Plants draw up moisture by a natural capillary action, like a paper towel pulling moisture out of a puddle on a table. Cotton wicks work well for most houseplants, but should be replaced annually. Synthetic fiber wicks can last up to 3 years, though they may have problems with thicker nutrient solutions. For harsh conditions, such as extended periods of drought, a glass fiber wick works best because it withstands mineral buildup from hard water and can tolerate temperature extremes. Types of containers. Types of SWCs include terracotta, plastic hybrid systems, and even concrete. Each type is best for a particular type of plant. Terracotta works best with Mediterranean herbs like rosemary and thyme. Leafy greens like lettuce and spinach prefer plastic hybrid systems. And a concrete planter can be used to grow olive trees or boxwood hedges. Terracotta's breathability prevents soggy roots but requires more frequent refilling. Plastic retains moisture better but may not hold up in a south-facing garden. Concrete planters hold large amounts of water, but an empty 24-inch concrete container weighs 40 pounds compared to 8 pounds for the same size in plastic, so it's important that an SWC is placed where it will have adequate support. Other factors. The growing media matters too. OMRI-listed Organic Materials Review Institute organic potting soils enhance moisture retention while providing proper drainage for container gardening. When growing herbs in self-watering containers, use a fertilizer with balanced NPK nitrogen-phosphorus-potassium ratios to provide essential macronutrients without overwhelming delicate root systems. The size of the root ball should match the size of the reservoir. Herbs need at least a 1 gallon tank. Tomatoes require a 5 gallon tank. Too large a reservoir wastes water, and one that is too small can promote mold because the root compartment becomes too confined. The type of plant, reservoir size, and environmental conditions will all determine how often you need to add water and may require some experimentation. Keeping a simple chart gives you a written record to guide you in maintaining healthy plants. Here's another article that appeared recently in the Arizona Republic, The 5 Most Venomous Animals and Insects in Arizona, by Tiffany Acosta. Something always seems to slither, hiss, buzz, or skitter across the Arizona desert. One minute, it's the soft rattle of a snake hidden beneath a cactus. The next, it's the dramatic jump scare of a beetle that looks far more dangerous than it really is. Arizona is packed with creepy-crawly residents, but not all of them deserve their bad reputation. Plenty of local critters are harmless, like tarantulas, which are more shy than aggressive. And Palo Verde beetles are basically giant flying acorns with legs. Even geckos and harmless king snakes help keep pests under control. But there are others you should absolutely give space to, not because they're ugly or scary-looking, but because they're venomous. Venomous creatures inject toxins through bites, stings, or fangs, while poisonous creatures are dangerous if you touch or eat them. In other words, if it bites you and you get sick, it's venomous. If you bite it and you get sick, it's poisonous. Here are 5 bugs and creatures with the most venomous bites and stings in Arizona. Gila monster. When a Gila monster bites, it chews venom into the wound, causing intense burning, swelling, and a feeling of pressure. The venom is potent and not usually deadly, but it can lead to significant discomfort, dizziness, nausea, and a drop in blood pressure. Seek medical attention to manage pain and monitor for complications. While waiting for help, keep the bite area immobilized and elevated. Avoid using a tourniquet or trying to suck out the venom. Tarantula hawk wasp. The tarantula hawk wasp's sting is often described as a searing electric shock that can incapacitate its victim temporarily. While the venom is highly toxic to insects and paralyzes them, it's not lethal to humans. The pain is often accompanied by redness and swelling. Treatment generally focuses on pain relief. Applying ice can help reduce swelling and discomfort, and anti-itch creams can alleviate symptoms. If you experience difficulty breathing, swelling beyond the sting site, or other severe symptoms, seek medical attention. Africanized honeybee. The sting of an Africanized honeybee, also known as a killer bee, is similar to that of a typical honeybee, but more intense. And because of the bee's aggressive swarming behavior, you might be stung multiple times. The venom causes a sharp burning pain and redness, swelling, and itching at the sting site. While the venom of one bee is not typically deadly to humans, multiple stings or an allergic reaction can be dangerous. Remove the stinger promptly, apply ice to reduce pain and swelling, and use anti-itch creams to relieve itching. Symptoms such as difficulty breathing, rapid heartbeat, and swelling of the face or throat indicate the need for medical care. Western diamond rattlesnake. One of the most dangerous animals you can get bitten by in Arizona is the western diamondback rattlesnake. Symptoms include intense throbbing, swelling, and tissue damage. The venom is potent and can cause severe pain, necrosis, nausea, dizziness, and difficulty breathing. A western diamondback rattlesnake bite is a serious emergency requiring immediate attention. Antivenom and other treatments are necessary to prevent severe complications. While waiting for help, keep the bite area immobilized and below heart level to slow the spread of venom. Avoid applying ice or using a tourniquet, as these can worsen the situation. Arizona bark scorpion. The Arizona bark scorpion delivers an intensely painful sting, often described as sharp and electric, causing numbness, tingling, and muscle spasms. The venom, while rarely fatal, can cause severe symptoms such as difficulty breathing, particularly in children and older people. Immediate medical attention is recommended, especially if symptoms are severe. While waiting for help, applying ice can help reduce pain, and over-the-counter pain relievers may offer some relief. Stay calm and immobilize the affected area to slow the spread of venom. From SouthwestGardener.com, Queen of the Night, Elusive Flowering Cactus. by Deanne Allman. Queen of the Night is an elusive cactus that's rarely seen in the wild, but it's widely regarded for its nocturnal flowers that simultaneously bloom once per year. While you might be daunted at the prospect of growing one, this Southwest native makes a virtually no-maintenance addition to desert gardens. Most people have never seen a Queen of the Night in the wild, since they're perfectly camouflaged in their native habitat. Yet here in Tucson, where Tohono O'Chul is home to the largest private collection in the world, they have rock star status. Every summer, Tohono O'Chul's Bloom Night is a major event attended by plant lovers from near and far who come to admire this elusive desert beauty. Growing this plant as a landscape plant will make you part of this enigmatic phenomenon. If you grow one in your garden, here's what you can expect. When not in bloom, this no-maintenance plant resembles a dead stick. Then sometime in late spring to early summer, it puts on a stunning display of nocturnal flowers that only last one night. These white beauties have an intense vanilla-like fragrance. Note that it will take several years for a new plant to start flowering. Flowers are pollinated by hawk moths, and oblong red fruits follow. Birds eat the fruit and disperse seeds in their droppings. Why I like this plant? Out of the ordinary cactus. Rewarding for plant enthusiasts. Fragrant white flowers. And virtually no maintenance. Things to watch out for. This is not a plant for the average landscape or casual gardeners. It's more for cactus or native plant enthusiasts who enjoy growing plants that are unusual. It adds little to the appearance of the average yard since, when not in bloom, it's barely there. When it blooms, it's magnificent, but only for a few hours. Flowers emerge one evening and then wither when touched by the morning sun. This is not a good choice if you're usually away in June or July. Historically, the Queen of the Night blooms in late June or early July, but the past 2 years, Tohono O'Chul's collection of 400-plus plants has bloomed in early June. Optimal growing conditions. If you're thinking of adding a Queen of the Night to your garden, you need to find a suitable place that will keep your plant healthy and looking good while minimizing maintenance for you. Here are the key factors to keep in mind. Temperature. Queen of the Night should be grown in USDA hardiness zones 9 or 10. It tolerates desert heat, especially when grown in part shade, and can survive temperatures down to 10 degrees Fahrenheit. Sun exposure. In its native habitat, Queen of the Night usually grows in the shade of a nurse shrub or tree. You'll increase your chance of success if you can replicate this environment. While you can grow one in full sun, it will be happier in dappled shade. Size and growth rate. Queen of the Night grows slowly. A typical mature specimen can reach a size of 3 to 8 feet tall by 6 to 10 feet wide. Tall plants benefit from support. Soil. Since its native habitat includes low-altitude flats and washes, Queen of the Night prefers soil that is sandy or silty rather than clay or rocky. Other location considerations. Queen of the Night can be grown in a container. Be sure it has good drainage and use specifically formulated cactus soil. Since it doesn't look like much when not in bloom, you've got a few options. You can keep it in an out-of-the-way place it will love, such as under a tree, and then bring it to the forefront as it's about to bloom. Or you can grow it in a container with other plants with similar growing requirements. Now here are the essentials for Queen of the Night. The origin is Chihuahuan and Sonoran deserts. Plant type is cactus, grows in zones 9 and 10. Cold hardiness down to 10 degrees Fahrenheit. Flower color is white. Flower season, spring and summer. Mature size 3 to 8 feet tall by 6 to 10 feet wide. Growth rate is slow. Needs filtered sun. Water needs are low. Pests and diseases none. Cautions, spines. And wildlife attracts moths. Planting Queen of the Night. To plant a Queen of the Night, dig a hole the same depth as the root system and twice as wide. You might be surprised to discover that this spindly stick of a cactus has a large tuberous root that looks like a parsnip on steroids. When mature, these tubers typically weigh 5 to 15 pounds, but can weigh up to 40 pounds. You're probably used to giving plants a good soaking immediately after transplanting, but that isn't the best practice with cactus. The Arizona Sonoran Desert Museum advises not to water succulents for 1 to 2 weeks after planting. The best time to plant Gwena the Night is in April or May, when higher temperatures encourage root development. How to care for Gwena the Night? When planted in the right spot, Gwena the Night is happy being neglected, so there's not much care involved. It doesn't need fertilizer. You only need to remove stems that have been damaged or that you want to propagate. It can exist on rainwater alone, provided you've had normal seasonal rains. If not, be the rain, irrigate to make up for what's lacking. Consider protecting a young plant from damage from pets, people, or wildlife with a wire cage or basket. Plants can be gnawed on or accidentally stepped on since they're so unobtrusive. And those of you who are regular listeners to this show know we feature stories each week from the terrific book, Chicken Soup for the Gardener's Soul. This story is called The Burning of the Leaves. It was written by Edie Cutler, and there's a quote here from Donald Culross Peaty. Nothing in this world is really precious until we know that it will soon be gone. The burning of the leaves. Papa, my grandfather, loved the fall. Every year, at the end of October, he would gather all the yard's leaves in neat piles along the curb and begin burning them. All along the avenue, as far as one could see, leaves would be burning. I used to wonder if it were prearranged, this ritual of disposal. Yet I never heard Papa phone anyone and say, "Well, today is the day, I'll see you at the curb." No, it just sort of happened. The fires would start in the late afternoon when the winds were low and continue into the early hours of dusk, the dying embers barely discernible by the time we children had to go in. Leaf burning was a family affair, a part of autumn I looked forward to every year. Adults raked all day, trying to keep the laughing children from running and jumping into the leaves before they got to the curb. At an early age, I delighted in the crackling sounds the flames made and learned respect for fire as well. Neighbors talked and caught up with the latest goings-on. The men said things like, "Seems there are twice as many as last year." Nana baked pies and invited folks in for food and company. The visitors lingered long after the embers were cold and spoke of the coming winter. Papa, though, stayed outside, standing guard lest some stubborn leaf try to reignite and escape. As a child, I never asked Papa why he seemed to love the burning of the leaves. I just assumed that everyone burned leaves in October, and he was just doing what it was expected of him. As I grew into adolescence, I found myself sitting at the curb, talking into the evening with him. And I became aware that it was more than a yearly chore for him. He once shared with me the times his dad had burned leaves on their small plot in the Pennsylvania hills. My great-grandfather was a coal miner and had little time to relax with his family. Papa and his 10 brothers and sisters all looked forward to spending precious time with their dad during the burning of the leaves. Papa was a quiet man, not given to a lot of talk. After years of working in open steel pits, he was still in great shape, but he moved slowly and always with a purpose. He and Nana were the anchors in my formative years, always there, same house, same comfortable routines. My parents and I lived a migratory army life. My grandparents rarely traveled. They were a constant I held even more dear as I grew into adulthood. Then, early one summer, Nana died. That fall, Papa moved in with my parents. With his flowers, his hobbies, and his family, he seemed content. But then one weekend, when I was home from college, I noticed that Papa was raking the leaves out to the curb. Mom hadn't told him. I realized that I was going to have to be the one to break the news. I went out and explained that here in this new town, there was an ordinance against burning leaves. All that smoke wasn't considered environmentally sound, and the authorities were worried about spreading fires. Papa never said a word. He walked away, shoulders as low as they had been at Nana's funeral. He put the rake against the house and went inside. The leaves remained at the curb until late fall winds scattered them back into the yard. A feeling of sadness stirred within me that autumn. I, too, had lost something that could not be replaced. For many autumns after that, Papa pruned, repotted, and did other garden chores, but he never again raked leaves. The year I got pregnant with my second son was also the year we learned Papa had cancer. The doctors didn't think he would make it to Thanksgiving. Papa was thinner and moved slower than ever, but we all lied to him and to ourselves, saying how good he looked and making plans for joyful, not empty, holidays. In the middle of October, I took Papa out to the farm my husband and I had just bought. The air was crisp, and Indian summer was at its peak. Papa walked the few acres with Adam, his great-grandson, as if he were patrolling an estate, with a measured step and head held high. I watched from the yard as he delighted in my four-year-old's exuberance. When they returned, I told Papa that out here in the country we wouldn't get fined for burning leaves. Could he please give me a hand with the task? He smiled widely for the first time in a long time, hugged me, and said, "Thank you. I'd be glad to help." Tears began to fill my eyes, and the closeness between us was cemented for all time to come. I raked, Adam ran through the leaves, and Papa supervised the careful placement of the leaves along the gravel drive. He instructed Adam on the hazards of fire. The lesson was like a favorite bedtime story heard and loved so many times before. And then Papa lit the match, and the first pile began to burn. The colors moved quickly together, swirling around. Leaves tried to escape, only to be brought back by Papa's deft control of the iron rake. The pile burned into the early hours of the evening. The pie and coffee Papa had that night before retiring were, he said, the perfect end to one of the best days he'd had in a long time. He died a week later in his sleep. A few days afterward, I received a letter from the Department of Sanitation. It had a warning and a copy of the local ordinance against leaf burning, but I hadn't really lied to Papa. There was no fine. I shall miss my grandfather always, and the burning of the leaves. That's called The Burning of the Leaves, written by Edie Cutler, one of the many stories of Bake Up Chicken Soup for the Gardener's Soul. And that's the Green Thumb Show for this week for Sun Sounds Radio. I'm Lee Murray, your reader. Thanks for joining us. Have a great week. Be safe and healthy, and we'll be talking with you soon.